Talk amongst yourselves.
Okay.
We've seen you staggering out of the work week, but now it's time to buck up, little camper. The weekend is here. This is a needcoffee.com podcast, and we're going to help you the rest of the way home. Stand by for Weekend Justice.
Coffee.com podcast. Welcome back to the Weekend Justice. We are assembled here, so to speak, in the Hall of Weekend Justice. And this week's Weekend Justice League, we have our Minister of Music, one of our Ministers of Music, Rob Levy, is here.
Hello.
Hello, Rob.
Hello.
We have Scott, who has returned from the depths of theatrical mayhem. Say hello,
Pantyhose
Scott.
Pantyhose itches.
Pantyhose itches?
Yes, well, it does.
Well, stop trying to eat it. And we have Doc Ezra is back again with us.
Greetings.
Greetings, Doc. So, first and foremost, before we... let's do this. We'll talk about the people we've lost, and then we'll talk about what you've been up to, Scott, because that will, I think, lighten the mood after we get done.
Definitely change it.
Yeah, we'll change it. There you go. We were discussing before we actually went live here. We've lost at least two major figures since we last joined you all. First, of course, is Charlton Heston, who is, as we were trying to come up with all the iconic roles that he's done, like Ben-Hur and Moses and Robert Neville from the, Omega Man that was better than I Am Legend, the movie, or I Am Robot, or whatever the fuck it was called, and... Taylor from Planet of the Apes, and just a very strong actor. So what, Rob, tell what was the thing about George Clooney again?
There was a piece on Charlton Heston, and they interviewed all these famous people. And Clooney said that, you know, one of the things Heston would do is if you were a young actor and you ever met him, he'd always be very encouraging to you. And he's like, somehow he met Charlton Heston, he was talking to him before he got sick. And Heston said something to him, you know, right off the bat he could tell that they weren't going to agree on politics, but they started talking about filmmaking. And Clooney was like kind of in awe of him because he's such a giant in the film business. And, you know, Heston ended up telling him, you know, son, I don't like your politics, but just keep with the acting because you got heart or you got spirit or something like that. And Clooney's like, you know, I just should have walked away then. You know, and Tom Hanks said a very nice thing about, you know, when he won two Oscars in a row, he got a very nice note from Heston saying congratulations. And he's like, okay, I don't need to do anything else, you know.
Nice.
And then they had a thing on NPR where this guy interviewed Heston in the 80s. And he said, you know, he interviewed him. He talked about his movies. And he's like, I didn't think the interview went very well because I really love his movies. And I kind of, you know, nerded out on him. And he said, you know, 3 days later, he got a note card in the mail from him saying, thank you very much for the interview. I enjoyed our time together. It was well worth it, and thank you for your thoughtful questions. And he's like, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years with interviews and stuff, and Heston's the only one that ever wrote me a thank you note for that. And he's like, just the man with the traditional idea of a gentleman in terms of how he conducted his business.
Nice.
You know? So
he was old school.
Yes. But the thing is, I mean, the thing is, you could argue based, you know, he's one of those actors like Jimmy Stewart and Heston and very few others, you look at their complete body of work, and it's staggering just how many amazing films they were in. You know, there's very few people left now that we can look at their body of work collectively and say, that was not a bad movie, that was not a bad movie, that wasn't a bad... I mean, almost everything he did.
And then you've got plenty of ones that you're like, that was a damn good movie.
Yeah, and, you know, even his bad ones, are, you know, but like El Cid, you know, you've got Moses, or Ten Commandments, you've got
right.
you know, literally everything, you know, even the stuff that he did towards the end was still, he was at least good in. And the movies that were complete crap that he was in, he always was the best thing in them.
Oh, yeah.
So you could always make the argument from an acting standpoint that, you know, he's one of those actors that took everything that he was in to a completely different level, and there's just not actors these days with those kind of chops anymore, sadly. So.
No, he made his bit parts pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
I was still remember being pleasantly surprised when he showed up in a cameo in the Tombstone or the other one. I was in Tombstone. Where he had a cameo. I mean, he might have had 10 lines, but it was just one of those things. You know, he steps out when his character's first introduced, and like, holy shit, that's Charlton Heston. This just got a lot more interesting. So yeah, he didn't have a lot of duds in that list, no matter how small the part.
Right.
Well, he also had that bit part in True Lies with Schwarzenegger.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Where he was like a very old Nick Fury.
I'd forgotten entirely about that.
Yeah, and I think the thing that was interesting too, from a acting standpoint, is he wasn't afraid to take a smaller part in a big movie, which is really, really just not really done anymore.
Right. Well, it's funny when I posted the thing about his passing. What I wanted to go find. Was actually the it was the Budweiser, right? The commercial he did for them.
Oh, yeah.
Where that was great because you actually playing off of what you're talking about, the fact that, you know, even with two or three lines, he's just so impressive on screen. I don't even remember what the line was, and, you know, hey man, how about a bud or whatever it was, and then a bud would just fly into his hand. That was brilliant. So. But no, I mean, you're absolutely right, especially the thing about the body of work. I mean, there's plenty of actors who are really good at even in crap movies. I mean, the first one that springs to mind is Denzel, who's been in, sadly, more crap movies than he deserves to be in, but is good in every one of them. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like Jimmy Stewart or any number of actors. Bogart.
It's the last. It's the last vestige of old Hollywood, I think. You know, it's just, and for pure movie fans, that's kind of a sad thing to see go.
Yeah.
You know, because the kids today don't appreciate it at all, and it's just sad to see it all go.
Well, they don't. They don't understand it. I mean, the thing. One of the best movie going experiences that I've had, which I've talked about before, is when Warner Brothers was doing. I think it was their 75th anniversary. They had basically had like a road show where they would go into major cities. And they showed a double feature of Maltese Falcon and Casablanca,
mm-hmm.
which was just badass to see both of them on the big screen.
Yep.
But they came out before the first movie and just basically said, just to answer the question that we've heard in some of these other films, the picture is not going to take up the whole screen. Because everyone is used to widescreen, you know,
mm-hmm.
movies. And this was basically what we think of as a TV aspect ratio. So they were actually getting people coming out and asking the management, where's the rest of the picture? So they have no sense of history. And I think part of the problem with that is that, you know, as I've complained about multiple times, is that the cinema-going experience has been denigrated to the point where there's very little point in going. You know, it used to be a big deal to go to the movies, and it used to be a big deal to go to movies that were making the rounds again because you know if you I remember when, you remember back when because we're going to talk about Disney in a second, but remember when they would go out and re-release like Snow White or something?
Yeah, every year, and it was, and people would still line up.
Well, because it was a big deal, because that was the only chance you had to see it. There was no, you know, it wasn't, you know, you had three channels, and it wasn't like it was playing all the time.
And you wanted to take the kids.
Yeah, well, you wanted to take the kids, but any film like that, I mean, anytime they would re-release it in theaters, you'd go see it, because it's not like you could turn on HBO or Showtime or take the DVD off your shelf, or as Doc and I were talking about the other day, download it to your freaking Xbox. So, you know, it's I'm all for the availability of this stuff, but it's I just, you know, I
know
wish
something,
there was... What's that?
It's something that my drama teacher did that I think might help with some of these kids, is she actually did a movie unit in class.
Mm-hmm.
And what she did was is she picked up, she showed us classic films,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, gave us the history and some of the stuff to look for and things. And admittedly, it was on, you know, TV, you know, VCR and all that. But it was interesting to have that taught to us. And I don't think kids are taught that.
Well, these days, I mean, like, kids are barely taught math. So, you
yeah.
know. So
I'm still trying to actually internalize the idea that Scott required an instructor for drama.
Doc stepped from the shadows.
Sorry.
Don't be sorry. It was
no,
great.
That was great.
But no, I mean, you know, they have no sense of cinema history. It's, and I'm
yeah.
sure that if there were some classes like that, that would be great. But I mean, the problem is, it's like, you know, people, I've heard of people who don't like Alfred Hitchcock. They watch Hitchcock movies and they don't get it because they're, oh, well, I've seen that before. It's like, well, yes, you've seen it before, but Hitch did it first. He originated a lot of the stuff that you take for granted now.
Yeah.
But you don't understand it. Like, you know, the example I always give is Psycho. People don't understand how groundbreaking it was to have your, you know, your heroine get killed in, like, the first, second reel of the movie, mm. and you're stuck with the killer for the rest of the film. Well, that was huge. So, but yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
I think there's something to that, because the last truly great, I think, three or four times that I absolutely went to a movie theater and was just ass-kicked was when they've all been the remastered classics. Because when they did The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, it was great on the screen.
Yeah.
Lawrence of Arabia on the screen is just amazing.
I can imagine.
A couple of years ago, they did Ben-Hur. And Citizen Kane as well. But I saw Ben-Hur about 3 years ago when it got reissued.
Yeah.
And I'd never seen it. Because I have a certain list of movies I won't see until I see them in a theater on film.
Nice.
And it was just absolutely stunning. So I think there is a scope to that. But just not done anymore.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is sad. And I think, you know, it's the Tarantinoization of Hollywood, in that everything has to be slick, fast, sharp, with a little bit limited attention span, and nobody wants to sit and watch older stuff before 1970 anymore. It's just...
Well, it also is a torture porn.
Yeah.
That probably doesn't help it either. You know, they don't see, like, people being torn apart and, you know...
Mm-hmm.
Butchered and murdered and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well,
and we want those kids off our damn lawn.
Doc, were you going to say something?
Oh, no, nothing in particular. I was just echoing what Rob's talking about when I did my brief tour of Nashville before being reassigned.
Yeah.
They have a theater up there, a great theater called the Bell Court.
Oh, yeah.
Old historic theater that was going to get... torn down, and a bunch of people pitched in, bought the place out, and turned into an art house theater. And they have some classic running pretty much every night. They just rotate through. They'll only do 4 or 5 days on any given film and then move on. And while I was up there, I got a chance to catch Casablanca on the big screen.
Nice.
That was intense. They did Ben-Hur. I didn't get to see that one. But yeah, they roll through a really steady schedule of these things. And I think they might only have two screens, maybe three. I'm not positive.
Yeah.
But one is almost always a classic, and the other one is some small art house flick that you're not going to see anywhere.
Right.
And well, there's not enough places like that.
But I wonder, do you think that modern, you know, the modern home theater setup and all that, do you think that these can approximate the same feeling as seeing it in, like, the classic old theater?
No.
No. Because it's you need the people.
Yeah, it's the community of being in the dark. It's it's the excitement of hearing the projector, that little buzz that you hear when the projector starts. And then
but people nowadays are assholes.
Well, that's true. I mean,
well, that's not a new development, Scott. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean...
Now, not like nowadays.
Well, no, I mean, it used to be... I mean, I think there's a point to that, and I've yelled about this before, and others have. I mean, I forget who was it that... Scott, was it John Rogers who was talking about the way to save movie theaters is to hire some fucking ushers?
Yeah.
What? Yeah, okay.
I read
yeah.
that.
It was either him or Ernie Klein.
No, I think it was John Rogers. I think it was John Rogers. But I'm sure Ernie would not begrudge that. But
Ernie actually has a piece on it.
Oh, does he? Okay.
Yeah, to where he's testifying for why he killed those three people in the movie theater.
Oh, I'm all for it. You've got people who are bringing their 6-year-old kids to R-rated films and
three-year-old.
Oh Jesus.
Three.
Oh yeah. Well, three. I'm not surprised. And the other thing is, again, because people don't understand the cinema, they're literally talking like they're in their den. They don't understand the whole community of being in the dark. You know, is that you're supposed to experience it, but you know, you can't really do. I mean, one of the other great cinema memories that I have is that, you know, I remember seeing Aliens in a packed house. And,
I still remember seeing Terminator 2. It was so funny because the scene where the orderly licks Lyndall Hamilton and you could hear, like, this audible, ew.
Well,
yeah.
And then, of course, when she kicks his ass, you can hear this one woman going, "You go, girl!"
Yeah. Well, the thing in Aliens when, you know, "Get away from her, you bitch," the place blew up. I mean, everyone was, like, on their feet going, "Fucking A!" It was great. And you just don't, you can't do that at home. I mean,
and
that's the thing that's missing. And see, that's what's funny is, and you know, I've discussed this before, is that the reason why people were, the theaters were worried about home video and worried about cable and worried about all these other things, and it couldn't kill them because people want to have that community, that feeling of community, but they've made the experience so bad that it's overwhelmed our need for community because we know when we go it's not going to be there. The closest that I've come to it, honestly, is we went to opening night of Snakes on a Plane, and there was that group feeling of we know exactly why we're here. We know what to expect. We have been prepared. Bring it on. And it was great because actually the light started to go down, and I'll never forget this. Somebody goes, "Let's do this!" And it was just like, it was brilliant. It was absolutely fucking brilliant. But it's as I complained at the time, you know, nobody went to go see it, and as a result, the whole... You know, when was the last time that somebody's done an internet marketing campaign like that? It's proved it doesn't work.
One of the things about places like the Belcourt, and there's probably a similar type theater in most of the bigger cities, is you get a place like the Belcourt.
Yeah.
I can go have my experience of being together in the dark because there's not going to be a gaggle of like 13-year-old mall kids who show up to see the latest from Akira Kurosawa's son.
Yes.
Or to watch Casablanca.
Yeah.
You know, I can go see a certain kind of movie and get that experience. It's if I want to go see this week's blockbuster that I'm pretty much hosed.
Yeah.
But then locally we just got I don't even know what you'd call it. It's an upscale movie theater.
Is it the Monaco?
Yes.
The Monaco is fucking brilliant. There's your unpaid advertisement for the Monaco in Huntsville, Alabama. Fucking brilliant. In fact, I told somebody who knows the owners of that. I said, tell them to bring that shit here.
Yes. It's I've seen a couple things there now, and it's a much better experience than any of the other theaters.
Well,
and they do it in part through the time-tested capitalist way of weeding out the chaff. You make it more expensive.
Well, it's not even that. When we went to go see, we actually went and saw Sweeney Todd. Let me just explain the Monaco to our three listeners. Basically, it's a regular theater that's got four houses that have balconies. And you pay a little extra to sit in the balcony. They have really nice seats and love seats up there. It's 21 and over only. So they have a full bar, right? Right, Doc?
They have a full bar that serves only the balcony.
Yep, and a dispenser for like 20 different kinds of wine, if that's what you want. They have a menu with like appetizers and the whole bit that you have access to once you get up there. And what I found was, I mean, our tickets, even with the internet service charge, were $10 a shot, and I pay that to go to a shitty theater here in Atlanta.
Yeah, and that's the whole economy of the size of the city, because it's basically a $3 premium on what I'd pay to go see a movie anywhere else in town.
But I bet you think it's worth it for the right film, right?
I've been to the theater twice in the past 2 years, and both of them were at the Monaco.
Yep.
And the next two or three I've got on my schedule will be at the Monaco.
Oh, yeah.
Because the other thing they've got going for them is, even when you just come in, before you get up into the balcony area, is that, you know, they have a bar, you know, sort of lounge on the bottom floor, but everything about the place screams upscale.
Yeah.
In fact, when I went with some friends, we kind of made the joke it didn't feel like it belonged in this town. Because it's the atmosphere is not friendly to the sort of screaming morons that show up at the mall's movie theater.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's more expensive to get tickets if you want. I didn't even look at their regular concessions, to be perfectly honest. They had a bar. But you're paying a premium on those things. But and they've also got the best whiskey rack in town. I'm just saying.
I'm surprised you've only been there twice in 2 years.
Well, I did mention the premium, right?
Oh, yes.
But yeah, it's obviously set up to cater to people that don't mind paying a little more for their tickets, for their drinks, for their snacks, for whatever, so that they can go watch a movie in a place that has a little bit of class.
Yeah.
And because it has that class, it doesn't seem to have quite the same problem. I'm sure there's, you know, you go in and catch a showing of whatever, you're bound to run into it every once in a while. But they're 2 for 2 so far. I expect my most likely run in with the crowd I don't want is when I go see Iron Man.
I bet if you're in the balcony, you won't run into a problem.
Well, that's the thing. If I sit in the balcony and there, and you know, the plebes are down below, that's okay. There's only so much irritation they can impose on me, because the balcony has its own. They've got a set of speakers back there.
Oh yeah.
If there's somebody muttering down on the bottom level, I'm never going to hear them over the movie anyway.
Well, and here's the thing too, is that, and I found this, and I back when we had the Gabfest running UBB on the old site, it was very interesting because we had people come in all the time, especially when we had that influx of refugees at one point. And I would get private messages, oh, be careful of so-and-so. He's a total prick, you know. But because we made it very clear from the get-go what we expected of people, to not, basically, don't be a dick, you know, the D-bad rule, the people that I was warned about were fine. And we only very seldom, maybe once a year, had to go ban somebody because they were being, you know, showing up and spamming or something like that. It's amazing when you set expectations of here's how you are to behave. People will generally rise to the occasion.
When
you go to your general AMC or your, I'm sorry, what?
I think Monaco's got it. I think they've
also,
you know, I haven't seen anybody removed from the premises, but I can't even imagine it will be necessary. Because like I said, if all you want to do is go see the Blockbuster, you can save $3 and go to the big, you know, 19 screen or whatever a couple miles down the road. So people who don't give a shit about the environment will just go buy the cheaper ticket.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, it's sort of a self-selecting thing so far. I'm curious to see how it pans out in the long haul, but because it's only been open since October or November, something like that. But it's certainly, everybody I know that's been has said good things about it. I think, I mean, there's another theater like that. It's not a Monaco. I don't remember the chain exactly, but there's one like that in Nashville that's got the same thing going on with the private balconies and the booze and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, we have that with the Lula here.
We're gonna see a rise in so we're gonna have two sort of schools of movie theater.
Right.
Possibly three if you get lucky and have a Belcourt or other little art house screen somewhere in town too.
Right.
So that people can actually go get the experience they want, because part of the problem, at least it seems, is that what we expect going into a movie in terms of that whole alone, you know, together in the dark, everybody sort of enjoying the film experience together. The generation after us doesn't have that expectation. What they expect is a place to go hang out and be moderately entertained with their friends, which, you know, that's fine. They've just come to expect that that's what the movie theater is for, and it's not what we were taught it was for. And I think it may have a lot to do with, you know, how big a deal it was to get to go to the movies when we were kids.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it was an event. And
it was great. And because that was the only place, like I said, you were going to see the movies.
Right. And now it's like, I'm going to hang out with my friends. We're going to the mall. We might see a movie. And that's just sort of what they go do on a Friday night.
Right, and they don't even know what's playing. It's like you show up at the theater and you go, what do we want to see?
Something. Yeah, whereas, you know, I might go see, when I was a kid, a half dozen a year, maybe a dozen, but every time it was a big deal.
Right.
You know, you planned for it, and then you went out and made a night of it. You went and got dinner, and you went to the movies, and that was an evening's family entertainment.
Right.
But I think it's just a difference in expectation that it got to the point where it was more affordable for people to go to the movies, just in terms of, you know, the larger economic situation. And two, you had a lot more people going to see movies, a lot more kids going to see movies unattended, starting younger.
Well, and it was a huge deal to go to the movies back when we were kids, because then when we got home, you know, we'd have to use the rocks and the flint and restart the fire in the cave.
Well, there's that too.
I mean, unless you could hire somebody, you know, fuck babysitting. You had to sit the fire because, I mean, you know, how often is lightning going to strike the right tree?
Yep, that coal isn't going to shovel itself.
Oh, good Lord. Well.
So now that we're all sufficiently dated.
Yes.
What's next?
Well, what's next is, I mean, we got done talking about the golden age of, you know, Hollywood acting. I mean, the golden age of animation has passed with the loss of Ollie Johnston, the last of Disney's original nine old men.
At 96 or something crazy? He held on.
he did. It was Frank and Ollie, as I understand it, for the longest time, and then, you know, we lost Frank a few years back, I think. But no, it's just, it's a shame, especially when I just published the Disney released their schedule through 2012, and we published it on the site.
The stench of Eisner lives on.
Well, I mean, there's a couple...
There's at least some traditional animation on that schedule. It may not be the best stuff they've ever done, but there's a couple of new IPs. You know, it's not all direct-to-video sequels.
Well, no, and I mean, they are doing, like, the Fairies thing, which is direct-to-DVD. But, I mean, and that's the thing, is, you know, you can only begrudge them that so much. I mean, the stuff sells.
Oh, like,
so, yeah, I mean, if...
Fortunately.
And I'd much prefer that they were doing, you know, Disney Fairies or Disney Princesses than, you know, Cinderella 4. What?
I said agreed.
Yeah, I mean, the cheap pools, that was the only thing, is that it's like, guys, you're just completely kind of denigrating your stable of classic films. And you compare any of those sequels to Toy Story 2, which was originally going to be directed to video. And then when they started looking at it, they were like, "Damn, this is too good. We need to release this in theaters."
Did the schedule have a third one on it?
Yes. Oh yes.
Excellent.
The whole cast is back. Well, except for Jim Varney, of course. But yeah, I mean they're all back. They're actually re-releasing the first two in 3D. Which should be interesting. And I'm kind of bummed that we've got no Incredibles 2, but we've got a Cars 2.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually enjoyed Cars. I was actually amazed that you had the opening sequence with like the equivalent of a NASCAR race, and I was actually engaged and interested because normally I could give a shit. So the fact that you're able to catch me from the word go and make it exciting and interesting, I actually enjoyed it. I mean, yeah, it was Doc Hollywood with cars. Who cares? It was cool. But still, I want another Incredibles movie.
Well, another good one.
Well, another good one. But, I mean, that's the thing. It's like if you got Brad Bird involved, you know, even in a producer capacity, I don't see how it could be bad. I mean, you know, The Incredibles was like the Fantastic Four movie we should have had, you know? I mean, it's really sad that one of the, you know, up until like, something like, you know, Batman, the Christopher Nolan Batman, one of the best comic book movies wasn't even based on a comic book. And The Incredibles was you know, just everything that we wanted in a comic book movie, and they didn't even have the sense, to my knowledge, to do, you know, based off of that, a comic book, or even, I don't even think they turned it into like an animated series, did they?
No.
I don't think they did, and I would have watched the hell out of that, too. I mean, I applaud them on not doing it because they might have thought they didn't have the time or the to put the quality into it. But still,
don't forget, that was when they were having the big argument, because, you know, that's when they were separating their deal with Disney.
Well, they were planning on it, but people said the reason that Cars suffered for, you know, it wasn't, and Cars wasn't, you know, to the level of a Toy Story or anything like that, obviously, but I mean, Cars was the one that was during the big breakup. But that whole Disney-Pixar split was in the works for a long fucking time. And that's the thing, too, is bear in mind that, like, you know, they're able to release their 2012 schedule because they start these films 5 years in advance. They have to. But...
Oh, yeah, but the thing is, you know, they just did... I bet you the producers and stuff like that just didn't think that this had movement, or they didn't want to spend the money to give Pixar, they don't want to spend more money on Pixar when they could be spending it on, like you said, Cinderella 3.
No, I doubt that, because Pixar's have been consistently critically acclaimed. I mean, Ratatouille, even though it didn't do as well domestically, fucking killed internationally. I mean, last I checked, I think it's probably broken 400 million worldwide so far.
Yeah, it's a very, very, well, it's a very smart film, too, for an animated movie.
Yeah.
What's that, Rob?
Well, in terms of an animated movie, it's a lot smarter than a lot of the more recent stuff they've been doing. The humor's a little more highbrow, but it's also a little bit more layered in how it sets up the jokes and things. And I think it's a pretty strong departure from what they've been doing.
But no, Pixar is always a safe bet when it comes to investment. I mean,
no, I agree. It's just I think there was always some resentment within Disney that it's not them doing it, but they also don't want to spend the money to make something that good.
Yeah.
Well, they are now because basically, you know, Lasseter's running the joint, so.
Yay.
Oh, yeah, but at the time, it was like, you know, yeah.
No, I know, but even with the Incredibles, I mean, the thing is, they've got the IP. I mean, it's theirs, so they could do an Incredibles 2 if they wanted to, so I don't know why they don't. I just want one. I know it's sad, but I do.
I'll give them time, Waves. They'll crank one out eventually.
Yeah, well. And, of course, I just thought it was interesting because I looked through that whole schedule and I was like, where the hell's Brad Bird? And it turns out he's doing a live-action bit on the San Francisco earthquake in 1906 with Disney and Warner Brothers, which I thought was fascinating that he would do anything having to do with Warner Brothers again after they screwed him on Iron Giant.
Yeah.
But it's
well,
amazing
you know
what a couple
probably,
Oscars will do for you.
Well, that and also knowing Hollywood, they probably have a whole new production team over there. They changed
it
like
yeah,
stuff.
I'm sure it's been replaced like 4 or 5 times since then.
Exactly.
So
it's like, where's the asshole? It's like, oh, he's gone. He's been gone.
Yeah, he's been gone. Well, and I mean, you know, the one thing is I think at one point whoever was over there at Warner Brothers at the time did admit that they had screwed the pooch on Iron Giant. I mean, on one hand, it could almost be forgiven from the standpoint of that, you know, what is it they had before then? Quest for Camelot and what was the other one? And Iron Giant was like their third and last that they were going to do for their feature animation. And you'd had crap after crap after crap, so why would you expect anything different? And by the time that they saw the film, they were like, oh, shit.
Well, Iron Giant 2 came out at a time when they didn't really know how to market it either. I think if Iron Giant would come out now, it'd be huge.
Oh yeah, it would be a huge thing, but it was one of those films where they you're absolutely right, they didn't know how to market it, and in fact they thought they had another, you know, piece of crap on their hands, and they didn't know to try until it was just too damn late.
And it's interesting now too is that when you know the local theaters in town do in these towns do these like midnight movies, you know, Iron Giant is one of the ones that packs the house, and you know that every time they do this, somebody somewhere scratching their head like, what did we do?
Right.
You know, it's really
I heard the best story on that. Kenneth Johnson, the Alienation and, you know, a prolific television producer. When the Fox, they told him they had to make a series out of the movie Alienation. And it was critically well received. Ratings were good. But Barry Diller, the guy who was running Fox at the time, said, oh, no, we're not doing any of this crap. We're going to go comedy all the way. And that season pretty much tanked. They actually had the president of Fox Networks, after that debacle, publicly apologize to all his affiliates that we are not going to do this again. We are sorry. Hollywood is full of stuff like that where they have one guy think, oh, I know exactly what we're going to do, and then it turns out to be a total failure.
Well, I mean, the other thing
is that... This
is
why we should run studios.
You what?
This is why we should run all the studios.
Well, I mean, what's crazy is that you... I mean, it's not... You can look backwards and see where they screwed up because, you know, hindsight's 20/20 naturally. But, I mean, there are bright people who have done really dumb things. And they're dumb in retrospect, but they make perfect good sense at the time. I mean, we've all done that in our own personal lives, as we've done something stupid and gone, well, shit, I don't know what I was thinking at the time because it looks dumb now, but it sure made sense when I pushed that button or whatever it was that I did.
Yeah, but if I'm the guy that sat there in the office saying, I think it's a great idea to do Daddy Daycare too, you know, I have to wonder what kind of impetus these people have.
Well, then the question becomes, I mean, and I'm not, and again, not just playing devil's advocate, not to defend idiots, but I mean, I would have to go back and look at how well Daddy Daycare 1 do in... wasn't that Eddie Murphy?
Yeah.
So chances are it actually did well because he does well in family films, not much of anything else these days. So it probably made money on video as well. God knows what it did internationally. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, the sequel itself might have turned out to be crap, but the idea of doing a sequel just based off of what the first one made, I mean, you could probably say, well, let's take a chance on it. Again, I mean, not to defend stupid decisions,
but
But I mean, that's the thing is, if success, you know, if it was that easy to have a successful film, then you know, you can look back now and see films that should have been successful that weren't. I mean, like, you know, I've been watching the 5-disc Blade Runner, and you look back at that now and you go, how in the hell did this not blow up? You know,
yeah.
but it was so poorly received that they actually destroyed a lot of the props and stuff. That's why there's so little remaining, is because they were so embarrassed by how poorly it did that they were like, what the fuck? So, you know, it's weird. No, nobody knows what's going to make a hit. Now there's things you can do, obviously, to make it work better as a hit. The obvious example
sequel.
That comes to... What?
Sequel.
Well, no, I mean, sequels can and, you know, can and can't work. I'm thinking more along the lines of if you are smart and you do, like, you know, the good marketing campaign. I mean, the 300 rule is basically, if your trailer is not as cool as 300, no one will go see you. I mean, perfect
hasn't
example.
Hasn't that been overwritten by Iron Man?
But don't for a minute think that the Iron Man trailer was not thought out because of the success of the 300.
No, that's good.
No, that's all I'm saying is that 300 is the first trailer in a long time that really, I mean, because if you think about it, 300, think about the aspects of 300. You've got a historical story. It's at least grounded in, obviously it's fictional, but it's grounded in this historical story that really nobody knows, quote unquote, nobody knows. We know, but I mean, the vast masses out there don't know it. Most people, you know, Frank Miller, the people who enjoyed Sin City knew it, but Sin City actually did not blow up at the box office. I mean, did very well in video, but it, you know, people don't know Frank Miller as a household name. Zack Snyder as a director, you know, had done the Dawn of the Dead remake, which was okay, but nobody, he had no name value. You look at the cast of that, there's nobody in there with any name value. I mean, what was it, Gerard Butler, the biggest thing he'd done before that was Phantom, the movie Phantom,
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and couldn't sing in it, God bless him. But what sold that movie was that trailer, where you watch that and you go, fucking hell, there's like, how could you have balls and not go, we must see this? It is manly. We must, like, eat meat off of sticks and things and wear red capes and shit and go to the film. But it's the same thing with Iron Man. You watch the Iron Man trailer and you go, fucking yes, because you realize that they've nailed it. And then you watch the Incredible Hulk trailer and you go, what? I mean, is there anybody who's watched the Incredible Hulk trailer and been excited?
No, that's not the right word.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm curious.
I just stayed away from the whole thing.
What was that, Doc? You said curious?
Yeah, I am, I must confess. But that's only because the bar was set so low with the first one.
That's true. I mean, there's generally nowhere to go but up. But, I mean, I'm so incredibly surprised that they've shown the majority of the outline of the film in the trailer. I mean, you've seen basically the Abomination. You've seen the Hulk. You've seen all the characters. Is there any reason to go see the film? We can make up the film in our heads, and it'll be better than what they're going to do. We know this.
Yeah.
As much as I want to see Ed Norton play a what's probably going to be a really great Banner, because I just like Ed Norton, and I'm kind of curious to see how well the script is since he helped write it.
Yeah,
you know,
that
I don't know.
Sounds weird to me. That whole, I know that's...
What's that? What sounds weird?
It still weirds me out that Ed Norton's doing the Hulk. I mean, it's just kind of like, okay, it's just, you're such a great actor, what the hell are you doing? But, I mean, I understand why, you know, in terms of money and a franchise and all that, but it still seems like a glaring mismatch to me, you know, that it just makes me weary.
I've got to figure there's something we're not getting out of the trailer, because, A, Norton's, I mean, he's at least a little bit picky about what he'll do,
yeah.
And Tim Roth is really picky.
Except
about
Courtney
what
Love.
He'll
Well, I mean, Tim Roth, as much as I love Tim Roth, there's nothing in the fucking world that will make me go see Funny Games. I mean, why in the world would he and oh, shit, what's her name? Oh, Naomi Watts. Why in the world would they be in a shot-for-shot remake of the original torture porn film? Why?
I don't know, man.
Yeah, I mean, remake, one thing. Shot-for-shot remake, where they actually went and, as I understand it, got blueprints of the original house to make the house exactly the same?
Yeah.
What?
You know...
Have we learned nothing from Psycho?
Tim Roth is two films away from the con circuit. That's all I got to say.
Ow.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Rosencrantz and Guildenstern alone put some notches above Gil Gerard. So.
That's true. He is fairly well removed from Rosencrantz and Guildenstern at this point, I must admit.
Yeah.
That's okay. It doesn't matter.
Oh, I know. Don't trust me. He and Gary Oldman, as far as I'm concerned, can do whatever the hell they want, and I'll probably forgive them.
But Gary Oldman's really smart in the movies that he picks. For the
most
part.
And good in everything.
You know, and
he's another one
movies,
of those actors that's good in everything.
And even the ones that he's not good in, he's like, I wanted to work with this director, I wanted to work with this actress, and that's why I did it. You know?
Yeah. But he's also really damn good.
I mean,
you know, it's just like, you know, it's you look at him and you go, holy shit.
And he's another one who doesn't mind taking a smaller role. Like, he did...
Well, he's Commissioner Gordon.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and he's absolutely nailing Batman Year One Jim Gordon. It's really scary how well he's nailing it, and he looks the part and everything. And the other thing about Oldman that never gets old is he could play villains for the rest of his life and draw a paycheck, and it would never be the same villain twice.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at all the villains that he's played, and they're completely...
The Professional.
Completely yeah.
What's it? The Fifth Element?
Oh, yeah, Fifth Element. All manner of... Air Force One, even. You know? That wasn't a great film, but he was great in it.
And he was actually halfway decent as Dr. Smith.
Yeah, frighteningly enough, in that crap movie.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I don't even know where we went from poor Ollie Johnson to talking about Gary Oldman. There's no telling.
But getting back to that, I think just as sad as the fact that, you know, we've lost this great artist, I think it's almost as sad that outside of a core group of people that are kind of on the fringe of popular culture, nobody cares. And that's sad, because in just the terms of, like, American popular culture history, you know, these guys were just as important as, like, you know, everybody that walked on the moon, you know, or things like that. I mean, there's just so few of them that did what they did so well, and nobody's paying attention. And that is what's really, really sad. Because, you know, people forget that back when they did the animation stuff that they did, it was strenuous, it was stressful, it was not at all necessarily the fun, glamour, glitz job is now.
No,
but I mean, people just don't understand that.
The thing that would really help people is, and it's a shame that the Disney DVD Platinum Editions have not held up to the standard that they did with, like, the first one, the Snow White.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you go back and watch, that's like the first animated feature. You know, that's you think about that and you go, oh, okay, yeah. No, it's like you know, what have we had like that? You know, Pixar did Toy Story, was the first CG animated feature.
Yeah.
But you very seldom get to see, you know, or appreciate the fact that, you know, it's like saying Edgar Allan Poe invented the detective story, you know? There are things that there are the first, and you go, oh, no, you don't understand. It's like there were none before this. This is where it came from.
A book that really helps. I mean, the Walt Disney biography. I mean, admittedly, it obviously focuses on Walt Disney, but it really captures how much work and effort and risk. I mean,
is that the Gabler book?
The big one, yeah. They basically mortgaged everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Snow White failed. They were gone. That was Gabler, the house, everything.
Gabler King.
And he worked those people like dogs to get it done.
Yeah. What was that, Rob?
Gabler came here in November for the film festival, and he did a presentation, and he showed the original Steamboat Willie and a bunch of the old Disney shorts. Right?
Yeah.
And he was talking about, you know, the only thing harder than writing the book was getting the archival shorts to be able to share with people. And that he's like, that alone was just this Herculean effort to get a copy of Steamboat Willie to show to somebody, you know, on like a print of it that they could show
right.
and talk about. And he did this whole thing where when he talked about the animators, he's like, you know, these people are absolutely painstakingly artists in the same way that, you know, you look at a Botticelli or you look at a Rembrandt, and he's like, but we don't think of it in that terms because it's not traditional paintings. Because
it's pop culture, it's animation, it's considered throwaway.
And he's like, nobody, you know, at the time, too, when you told somebody what you did, you're like, oh, I'm a comic artist or, oh, I'm an animator. It was like the bottom of the rung job to do, and he really put it into that context of where it was in terms of, like, the society of the era and the culture of the era of when this stuff was made. It just completely changes how you approach the work. And I think in this case, you know, we're losing a very vital part of what has made us a culturally literate nation. And sadly, it's not going to be replaced. It's not going to be passed on. You know, that's the big thing, is what kind of legacy do you leave? And when you have a legacy that's brilliant, but it doesn't get properly caretaken or passed on, that's where it's really sad. And that's what really makes me sad about these guys, is because there's, you know, this should have been on all of these guys when they went. It should have been a big deal. And it just was a footnote. And it's disrespectful, and it just really pisses me off.
Well, the other books that I would recommend, and I'm looking at them on my shelf right now, are John Kanemaker's Walt Disney's Nine Old Men and the Art of Animation, and Michael Barrier's Hollywood Cartoons, American Animation in its Golden Age.
Yeah,
those are both excellent books, and I've read them both cover to cover, so they're really good at putting things into context. So, okay, well, we sounded the death knell for Hollywood and animation. Now what?
Well, I got a terminally ill game designer.
What's that?
A terminally ill game designer.
Well, tell us about that.
Eric Wujcik, whose name I probably just butchered the pronunciation of, Wujcik, has been basically diagnosed with phase 4 pancreatic cancer.
Jesus.
As of like 3 months ago. He's mid-50s probably.
Wow.
He was big in Palladium games, wrote the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles RPG, which, for anybody that did a lot of gaming in the 80s, was a staple.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a number of spinoffs after the bomb, which was a post-apocalyptic type thing and other stuff. He's I don't know what the ETA is, just that he's basically past the point they can do anything but make him comfortable.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's following so close on the heels of Gygax, it's kind of grim news. I'm about ready to see if somebody will send a nurse over to Steve Jackson's place and just make sure he's okay. Because we're running out of the originators pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I remember seeing that. I forget what blog I saw that on, but they were reporting on that and had a big picture up of the TMNT game and such. But, wow. Well, every single media, it seems like we've got somebody that we're losing or have
Terry
lost.
Terry Pratchett?
Yeah, and Terry Pratchett.
Oh, don't even get me started on that.
Yeah.
Well,
don't get me started.
like we've ever been able to stop you.
No, Terry Pratchett, Discworld Books, unbelievable author, was recently diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, you know, when I heard that, I just was like, you know, it's not fair. I was just like, you know, it's not fair.
Well, it's you know, I lost like two grandparents to Alzheimer's, so you know, it's terrible for somebody like Terry, but it sucks for anybody. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's because it's one thing to lose somebody, like, you know, for them to pass away, you know, or for somebody with, you know, like you're talking about with the pancreatic cancer. I mean, I was looking on Wikipedia to see what his status was, and that, you know, he is, you know, he's got a blog that he can't update, but I mean, you can at least talk to him. And the problem with Alzheimer's is you get to the point where, you know, I would go see my grandparents, and they wouldn't even know who I was. And these are like the people who helped raise me, and that's really hard. I mean, that sucks to sit there and go, you know, the person that I knew is gone. Their body standing in front of me, talking to me, but they're gone. It's really fucked up. So I, you know, that, to talk about not fair. That illness is not fair to anybody who gets it. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. Totally fucked. But no, he, as we've announced on the site, he is not, he's pissed off. And, you know, he donated basically, what, $1 million, and there's people trying to match funds, and...
Oh, no, he donated that. $1 million is nothing in England now.
Well, but he's going to go down kicking and screaming, which
is
going to be great. And I admire him for it.
Yeah.
But
oh, that's great. It's just, you know, when I read that, it's like, yeah, I just was like, there are so many other people.
What did I just really get done saying?
I know. But, you know, I'm actually, I think in some cases, I'm a meaner bastard too. There are actually a lot of people that I would wish, you know, something this horrible on. But,
well, I've seen this episode of the new Twilight Zone.
I'm trying to think. No, I'm trying to recall the episode you're talking about, Nuts.
It's the one where they get the little box with the dome on top, and inside there's a little red button. If you push the button, you will get, I forget what the amount was, but let's just say it was $100,000. But by pushing the button, someone that you do not know will die. And the whole episode is this man and wife going back and forth about, you know, what if it's some old woman? What if it's some infant? You know, we don't know them. It doesn't matter. And so finally they push the button. And the guy shows up the next day and hands them the money and takes the box back from them. And they said, what's going to happen to the box? He says, oh, we'll reset it. And they said, well, then what? And then I assure you, we will give it to someone that you do not know. It's a great fucking episode. There really were some great episodes of the new Twilight Zone. I know I love the old Twilight Zone, but yeah. I used to watch the new Twilight Zone because there were some fucking great episodes in that.
Yeah.
But, oh, God. Can we even come out of that and talk about your shit, Scott?
Well, I think we need to cheer up a little. And what's funnier than me and drag? Really? And not even, not even,
right?
Not just
I hope
drag.
That's rhetorical.
And not just drag, Star Trek drag.
There's only one thing funnier, but that's okay.
Oh, I'd like to hear this. What's funnier?
We're not going there this week.
We got a moratorium. Maybe next week.
Oh, that, yes. Okay, never mind. I got it.
Oh, good Lord.
Should I explain?
Please explain. Do so quickly, because we don't have a lot of time, because we've gone through the parade of woe.
There
here.
Is a cabaret group in Tallahassee called the Mickey Fowles Club. They pretty much satire anything and everything. They are all inclusive. You know, they don't discriminate for, you know, disability, sexual orientation, acting ability in some cases. But the piece I was in was a setup a Star Trek parody. And we have several black women in the cast, but they thought it'd be funny if someone else, say me, played Kenneth Uhura. So they had me in the dress and the wig and the whole nine yards. Not in blackface. I do have to clarify. Not, you know, we didn't go that far. But yeah, and I,
what's
oh,
that?
Yeah, no.
What
oh
was that,
yeah,
Doc?
I agree. No, he said it's probably for the best.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. But
yeah.
The joke was we had one of the women in like where Chekhov would, and when I answer the captain's, you know, is there anything from Starfleet? She goes, she gets like the suspicion, like, wait, what? What's going on here? What? So that's kind of the joke.
I think
what's really
Scott would be great in a remake of Soul Man.
No. What's kind of sad is everybody says how great I looked. I'm like, I actually looked good as, I don't want to look good as a woman.
I'm sure the rest of the world agrees with you.
Scott.
I know. Trust me. I've heard it. I can't say anymore. I've already heard it all.
Oh, speaking of blackface, to steer back to something lighthearted and, you know, movie related. About the Tropic Thunder?
Yeah.
Is that the title?
Yeah, I posted that trailer. Looks fucking hysterical.
I'm glad Robert Downey Jr. is back.
Yes. I've missed him. Between that and Iron Man, I think we can safely say that he is now back.
Oh, I'd say so. I'm really looking forward to his turn as a famous Oscar-winning Australian actor who undergoes a surgery to become black to play a sergeant in a Vietnam movie.
Yes.
Yes.
That's genius. That is genius. So that looks like it's going to be a great movie. And again, that there's a trailer that you watch and you go, oh shit, I got to see this.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But okay. Well, I don't think we should probably wrap up since that'll take us another 15 minutes.
At least.
So what? Let's hit our recommendations while we still have the stamina for it. Scott, what have you got?
Well, I saw this book that looked kind of interesting. It's called The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher. It is supposedly it's a story about a murder in 1860 of a 3-year-old, and there's this investigator in Scotland Yard who is making the most outrageous suggestion that it might have been one of the members of the family, and it really set up because of the publicity of this, it really set up like the traditional. It was one of the things that inspired a lot of the murder mysteries of the time. Like, I think they mentioned, some suggested this may have been one of the inspirations for Sherlock Holmes. So it sounds interesting. I mean, it really talks a lot about, you know, some of the assumptions people made about how family was and how families were pictured, but what families were really like.
Right.
But it looked.
Well, what's the title again, Scott?
The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher?
Yeah, Whicher by Kate Summerscale. Yeah, there's actually a review of it in Entertainment Weekly. That's what caught my attention.
Cool. Rob, what have you got?
Couple things. New Tapes and Tapes is out, which if you like really good tight indie rock is worth it. And then I'm very skeptical of when actresses or actors make records. It just scares the shit out of me. But
let me guess where you're going, Scarlett Johansson?
No, but
no.
I mean, but that does scare me. But the record by She and Him, which is M Ward and Zooey Deschanel. It's
really?
It's records. It's great. It's like a cross between Hawaiian surf music and a lot of the old Phil Spector records.
Wow.
It's great. It's really great. Yeah, it's M. Ward and Zooey Deschanel. It's called She and Him Volume 1. And
which is funny because I can't even imagine, because the thing I know M. Ward from is this great dirge-like version of Let's Dance that he did on like KCRW.
Yeah.
So for you to say, oh, it's a Phil Spector Hawaiian surf record.
Well,
it sounds insane.
It's self-indulgent without being self-indulgent, which is kind of weird. But it's she's got a great voice. They worked together on a soundtrack song, and they got along really well. And she said, you know, when I'm not acting, I just sit at home with my piano and make these little demos, but I'll send them to you. And then he's like, these are actually really good. Let's work. And it actually is, it's very tuneful, and it's got some very good little melodies on it. It's
nice.
Yeah, I mean, it just completely floored me at how interesting it is. And it's, you know, it's kind of, she's kind of got that whole White Soul, Dusty Springfield kind of voice down, but they wrap her with melodies where it's not going to sound really stupid. It really, really works.
Huh.
And then I know we've been horribly dark tonight, so I thought I'd cheer us all up with, and I, you know, I was completely, completely not expecting it, but it's been, I think, 19 years since the B-52s have made a record. And the B-52s are always one of those bands that their records are fun, which you're like, okay, they're fun, they're disposable, you throw them away. But they have a new record called Funplex, and it's actually really, it's fun, it's light, and you know, it's light pop stuff, but it's really, really, really good. Because you're kind of like, I mean, after the last one, you're kind of like, and after the one before that, so you weren't really expecting much. It's probably the best thing they've done, some of their stuff in the mid-80s. But it goes back to that sort of core surf party B-52 sound and throws in enough electronica that it doesn't kill it.
Right.
And it's really kind of a fun record. It's a very light, fun, you know, put the top down, drive around kind of record.
Nice.
And it's silly. And, you know, Fred Schneider has one of the most distinctive voices. So when he pulls off these really cute hooks with his voice, you know, it's really, really great. So I was completely caught off guard by it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, Doc, what have you got?
And it's hardly a new thing, but I just got around to it today, so I'm sharing it. Clutch's album from 07, From Beale Street to Oblivion. Fantastic stuff if you're a fan of the band at all. And it was one that they sort of, and they've gotten bad about this with their last two or three records, they sort of sneak these things out the door with minimal fanfare because they're kind of a cult-following band anyway. And even as a fan, that one had sort of slid past me. So I highly recommend anybody interested to check that out.
Well, and of course, anyone listening to the podcast, Clutch was kind enough to give us permission to use their song for the theme music. So if you're wondering what the fuck is this Clutch sound like, you're about to hear them in a couple minutes. So
yeah.
Fucking badass. So excellent. Well, my pick is BBC Home Video just put out Michael Palin's New Europe. And
cool.
Michael Palin is, he's done all these, like, travel documentaries where he's, you know, gone all the way around the world trying to do it in 80 days without actually hopping on a plane and went through the Sahara. And they're just really fascinating, not just because, you know, it's Michael Palin, but apparently this is what he does. The Himalaya is another one he did. But they've just released this one. It's got an interview with him and some deleted scenes. But I'm really looking forward to digging into it if I can ever get done with my Blade Runner marathon of going through that set. But no, so that's it. That's what we've got. That's it. That's our rhyme. Take it to the streets. All right. Well, I guess we will adjourn for another 2 weeks, and we will be. By the time you're listening to this, I will be in New York Comic Con. So we'll see what happens there.
Avoid the scrolls.
Yeah, I will. I will try my best to avoid the scrolls. I'm allergic to them anyway, and they're not very good fried. So, all right. Now is the point where we all say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, and then we're about. Lovely. That was actually coherent.
Yes.
And we leapt upon it.
Exactly.
Like hungry lemurs. I don't know how lemurs act when they're hungry, but I imagine it's very leapy.
Yeah, probably.
I think you've got your tagline for the post-theme song wrap-up right there.
You think?